Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, September 1st, 1999. We are in the fireside room of Koinonia this afternoon. Your presenter's name is Ruth Doherty. Today's session number is 99-3. Ruth continues her series on the medieval history of the church with this session entitled The Age of Faith. What faith? Let's listen in.
16 decides to be a Christian and decides and actually conquers the others and becomes the ruler of the Roman world. And in 321 issues the tolerance for Christians. But the medieval world, it still remains a very classical world. The medieval world really begins after Rome falls seriously. After the Roman church no longer, the empire really breaks down in the West. And that happens about 476. And then you can have a debate when it ends on the other end, whether it ends at 1300 or 1400. I think, you know, it's stretching to go a lot further than 1400. Do you have any questions before we begin officially? I've got some words on the board, so then we'll begin. I have some words on the board here that you don't have to get scared about. Gnostics and Monophysites and Donatists and Arians. I'll mention them because they are important, but we're not going to spend a lot of time on a lot of theological issues debating just how people understood who Jesus was. The Gnostics, we're not really dealing with who Jesus was as much. That was sort of a mystery cult. It comes up again very often. It's very close to the Persian understanding of mystery things. It comes up in the Bogomils, in what we see is the Bosnia-Herzegovina in Yugoslavia. It comes up again in the Albigensian. It's the idea that the earth is bad and the spiritual things are good. So it denigrates anything earthly. Therefore, they say Jesus could not have been a human person, because if he would had any humanity about him, that would have been no good. And therefore, he was simply divine. And it is all an illusion that he was human. The Monophysites are saying, Jesus, you saw a man, he was a real man, but he was really God. He had only one nature, and that was divine. The Donatists were people that came in, it was a heresy, all these are heresies. This is a heresy that came in after Constantine had said, Christianity's okay in the Roman Empire, you don't have to be persecuted any longer. And then there were a lot of people that came out of the closet and said, yeah, I'm a Christian. So Donato or something like that, he was in Africa, Carthage, said, well, you know, those people that have been Christians all along are the good guys, and those who just picked it up are not so good any longer, and they should be in another category. Also, if you have a priest that has not always been the true Christian, forget him. You can't have you can't really receive a sacrament through him. That was a Donatist heresy. Graham Greene wrote a novel not too long ago, and I can't think of the name of it. It's based in Central Europe, where he deals with that particular issue, where you have a drunken priest who's running away from the authorities, and he hides out, and the people go to him in order to get the Eucharist, in order to be saved. What's the name?
Doesn't that happen in Latin America?
The power and the glory.
But that's Latin. I thought it was Latin America.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, Latin America.
Mexico.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the question really comes out in Graham Greene's: can they really have receive the communion efficaciously through a priest who's not perfect? And the Arian we'll talk about it in just a little bit when I show you some slides with this.
There, thank you.
Christianity started, you know, in the Roman Empire. If we take for granted that Christianity came out of a sort of, was all white, and then Christianity was there, we've got a strange illusion. Because here, in the Roman Empire, you know what they're worshiping. You know, they're coming back. They've got their Greek gods, and they have changed their Greek gods, given them all Roman names, and so they continue to worship their Greek gods. So when Christianity comes in, and you hear Paul talking about it, saying, well, here's an altar to the unknown God, he incorporates Christianity into the old way of thinking. So it is not, this is something that happens continually. You have this continual way of incorporating Christianity. And here's an interesting concept. Here is a cross I showed the other day of Christians and a gold cross. But I didn't point out there's a Caesar. Mm. Here is the eagle of the empire. Mm. So, you know, you're going to stay on the safe side. If you're going to have a Christian cross with all those jewels, you're also going to say, but I don't want to take a chance. And the cross is something that we'll be dealing with later on in terms of people's, the embarrassment of the cross. So one of the things that people did is build churches over Greek temples or Roman temples. This is Santa Maria Maggiore degli Minerva. In other words, over the Temple of Minerva. You go to Assisi, and right in the center of the city, there is a saint, and I think it's another Saint Mary, degli Minerva, over the Church of Minerva. You go to Syracuse in Sicily, and the cathedral has, now these are Corinthian columns, but these are newly built in the 400s of the 5th century. But there you can actually see the old Greek pillars there, which they have incorporated into the walls of the church. It is the cathedral in Syracuse in Spain, in Sicily. And I went to an Easter service in a church in Sicily, another Santa Maria delle Grazie of the Greeks. And there were the pillars, the old Greek pillars. So one of the things they've always done is say, how can we take over this religion? We're going to supplant the old religion and put Christianity on top of it. You've always got a few remains, consequently. This is another Saint Mary degli Grazie. By the way, this is the cathedra, the chair of the bishop, and the priest sat around here, and there was no altar. And if I go back to this church here, all of this altar is placed in front of that area. We did not have an altar initially. Well, one of the things that's happening during this time, as Rome weakens, as they are no longer have the strength here to push back all of these, the Franks, the Goths, the Burgundians, the Lombards, the people, Saxons, who are eager to get to the Mediterranean because it's warm down there and they can grow things. Up here, the soil is clay. They do not have plows that can dig that clay soil. Here the soil is easy. You can have two crops a year. So they want to come down here. So when they come in here, what are they going to bring? These are people who have been revering nature. So what are they going to bring here? They're nature gods. Their understanding of nature. And if they are going to be Christianized, the only way they're going to be Christianized, if to some extent you talk to them in their own terms. And this is what we were saying a little bit before about listening to the teenagers and so forth and coming in their own terms to things. Well, when some of these were Christianized, one of the heresies that I mentioned before was Arian. The Arians did not believe that Jesus was really God, that he was maybe the best man that ever existed, but not God. Well, this is the heresy, and I really should say belief rather than heresy, but heresy is a term that was used by the church. This is the belief that the most of these implants are picking up. In fact, the Arians were great missionaries, and so they went out to all these new people and said, and Christianized them, that they Christianized them as Arians, so that you had a single God, our God, that was not a lot different, but they did not see Jesus as a savior in the same way that Christianity today is saving, saying that. But by the way, this was an Arian baptistry, and inside, the decorations inside are almost identical with the Christian baptistry, which is about a block away, which was built a little later. And this is an Arian church. This is in Ravenna, an Arian church that was built in Ravenna. And this is in the 500s. So, you know, well, the worship was I don't know what the liturgy was, but there was a lot of similarity between the Arians and the Christians. But there is always that attempt in the church to eradicate the Arian heresy.
So the Arians were barbarians that came down and accepted portions of Christianity? Is that what?
They were these barbarians, and barbarian is a word that the Greeks named from ba-ba-ba. They couldn't understand what they were saying, so they said they're just ba-ba-bas, and so we called them barbarians. Yeah, and they had their own language, they had their own culture, and when they came down, they had their own religions. And they were Christianized as Arians. Did I say it right now so you can? Is that?
No, that's clear.
Is that? Okay. My daughter is standing here in a circle of yew trees. This is in the marshes between England and Wales. And those nymphs in the back are my granddaughters who are now 18 and 20. A circle of yews was considered a very holy place. And we should get Susan here to count the rings on these trees. The ancient people, the barbarians, would have planted yews in a circle in which they would then worship their gods. So what did the Christians do?
Chop down the trees.
They chopped down the trees. And they did that in some cases when they were holy trees, especially. Boniface did this in Germany, and people thought he was going to be killed from knocking down the tree. He said, "See, our God is more powerful than that tree." Mm. But actually, they chopped down the trees. And that's kind of a natural thing for people to do. But they see what's in there? What do you see beside the trees?
Headstones.
The church has taken over that place and made that a cemetery. And, oops, I'll show you the next slide. And also planned to put a church there. So right in the circle of yew trees is this little church. Now I want to have you think. Close your eyes if it needs to be. But what it would be like to live in the Middle Ages, because we have no scientific knowledge of what causes things, why there's thunder, why there is lightning, why sometimes it rains and sometimes it doesn't, why there's a plague of locusts, why you're sick, why anything happens. There is no answer. And there's also that when there, the rational people that had under any understanding of what classical literature there might have been, were picking up Plato, who said, you can't believe what you're seeing. Everything that you see is only a symbol of reality. It's not real. You cannot trust your senses. Can you imagine what it'd be like to live in a world? What would it be like? How would you feel if you lived in that kind of a thinking? What would it feel like?
I imagine it would lead to superstition.
Sure. And like, what kind of superstition is it? You know, you don't have to answer that, but superstition was something that you're looking for answers. You're looking for answers. So there were people that looked to the stars. How does the stars controlling us? The old Romans were counting the birds. We have a radio station that comes from Seattle. He counts the birds on the wire. And I think, boy, he sounds very Roman, because that was one way of identifying whether you have a good omen or a bad omen. Mm. They were always looking for omens, looking for ways. And then you're scared. Doggone it, if you really were there, you would be scared. You wouldn't know what was going to happen next, and you couldn't control your environment. There was no way of controlling it. So to some extent, Christianity is an answer. This is maybe we can have a God that will help us out. And so they're looking for a God that can come in and save them in a whole variety of ways. And I've got a slide of St. Augustine, Gregory the First, the Pope, later on, and I know it's going to be out of place. Gregory the First said, we've got to have miracles in order to get people to believe. And so they are believing in miracles in a way that we may not believe in miracles. Now, we can say now, scientifically, I know why that happened. But they didn't have that kind of an answer. So everything was sort of amazing. My daughter, again, in front of this little church. So the parish priest becomes very important. This is a church that's early on. I'm not sure just how early this is. It may actually have been a chapel. It's a later church that was built in this area afterwards, or converted to a chapel, which means a Protestant church. The parish priest had a lot of responsibility for training the people. Wouldn't you think? Okay, we're going to straighten everybody out, right? This was what the popes were always hoping, they could straighten out the people. But who is the parish priest? How many parish priests went to seminary? What kind of training did they have? They could probably mumble the Latin Mass. You know where we get the word hocus pocus? Mm-hmm. Where, Paul?
From the Great Thanksgiving, hocus pocus man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. From the Latin, from part of the words of the Mass. Hocus pocus, it was a mystery. It was, and we'll talk more about that later on, but the parish priest, if we were lucky, could say the Our Father well, and the Lord's Prayer, and the Apostles' Creed. And this is what he was supposed to teach the people, and that was all that was expected, that they would teach the Our Father and the Apostles' Creed. Whether they understood it or not, that's something else. That was their expectation of the people. So they're going to bring in all of the faith from before, supplant it, and supplant a Christian faith very lightly on top of that. And here is another one of these holy places. This is St. Mary's in Pilleth in Wales, where there's a holy well. So the holy wells are very important, and they're especially very important in Celtic countries, which would be Scotland and Ireland and Wales and Brittany and Galicia in Spain. So, I'm sure there are in other places too, but this church was built here in this place because of the holy well there. And the water was very important. My daughter tells about, she said, and you notice this if you ever go into the churches, any of those churches in Europe, whether you see this, you might see a huge cover over a baptismal font. Why is that there? Just because it looks pretty? You know why? The people wanted that holy water. This was very special water. And so they would steal the holy water out of the baptismal font. And then they would expect miracles to happen as a result. Another thing that they were doing in Wales, as the story goes, is that they would bring newts or nymphs and put them in the holy water so they wouldn't turn into dragons. So they put this huge, heavy cover on the baptismal font and chained it down. This is one of the, I'm going to show you a lot of things that are now in the sculptures of the churches. These are on churches. These are not secular buildings. This is the Green Man. And if you notice, if you look at him, you say, you're not sure whether this is a Green Man is somebody that is definitely involved with the seasons, with plants, with the success of growing things. Well, I can't think of a better term for that, I don't know. When you look at this guy, you're not sure whether he's putting out or he's taking in. This is in Leinster in England. In this guy, you can see him all over the place. You'll find him, once you look for him, you'll see him in a lot of different places. This is the tympanum in the church where my son-in-law was priest in Clanbattern Far in Wales. Can you see the Green Man here? The tree coming out of him? Not only is there a Green Man here, but there is also the sun. These are sun worshippers. This was in the 1000s that this tympanum was built on a Christian church. You also have these animals on each side. Here's a lion, and I can't really tell, this is probably a leopard over here. This is in Salou. It's a much later thing. This is in the 12th century, and you see all these heads just popping out of this fake greenery. You are not going to see until the 13th century are you going to see real greenery. And if you stick around long enough, I'll tell you why that is. But I'm not going to tell you today. This is another beast that's in Deerhurst in England. This is an Anglo-Saxon image in Deerhurst. A beautiful piece of sculpture. But why is it in the church? This is Houndstooth. This is in Iffley in Oxfordshire. And you have these animals with their teeth, and look at those teeth biting onto something. But here are not only the animals, but the women. Here's looks like the lady and the lord, and here's another animal. And then if you look over here, this guy's upside down, and he's being chewed on. This is the combination. There's not a lot of difference between the animals and the humans. And that's easy to see. This is again in Leominster. Leominster. This is a monastery in England named after a lion. The lion becomes very important. And you know what? That lion looks hungry. I would not want to be there. Rick Kemmer said this is a, when you see lions, it's, you know, the lion lies down with the lamb. I'll tell you, this is not a lion that's going to lie down with the lamb. This is one that if the lamb came by, he is going to take it. This is in Canterbury, down in the crypt in Canterbury. Look at those teeth. He would love to get a bite. There are more. Saint-Trophime in Arles. We were just there this year, and it looks so sort of like, you know, isn't this really staid and nice? These guys are standing there so calmly, but what's at their feet? And I want to focus this a little bit. Maybe you could focus it, because I want to show this. See, when some of these pictures are taken, you don't always get it. See this sort of devil here? Mm. And this human? But look at this guy. Now you're going to have to focus it back. Mm. This is when you walk around, this is what you see. You see this lion. Mm. And now turn the corner. Now we have to focus this so it's just right here. Isn't this lovely? Gentle nature, huh? You can really trust nature and how well, that's great. How lovely nature, gentle nature, beautiful nature. We have a hard time conceiving nature in these terms when we're in this beautiful place like Holden. But in the Middle Ages, nature was not fun. You had to put up with some really dire stuff. Here's Saint-Gilles, which is not very far away from there. And again, some very figures. These have been very badly destroyed through the years. Look at those creatures down at the bottom. I'll bring you a little closer to one. Hmm. Yuck. This is on a Christian church, you realize. This is one of the pilgrimage churches. Hmm. And Saint-Gilles was supposedly saved by a deer. But that's only one aspect of it. Not only do you that, you have all these dragons all over the place. This is in Canterbury. They seem to be warring against each other. Saint Michael, by the way, why was Saint Michael such an important saint? What did he kill? A dragon. How about Saint George?
A dragon.
These became saints because of their aunt getting rid of the devil. This is a pulpit in Germany. Not only do you have this sort of serpentine thing at the bottom, which is a reminiscent of the serpent that, you know, tempted Eve, but you have an eagle, you have a man, here you have a lion, here you have a man being twisted up and eaten. I don't know if you can see that. His head is being eaten by snakes. Here is a mermaid. Now, one of the things that is most typical for the most demonic people, they believed that deformed people were the devils. Devils were everywhere. And so they, you know, I think they put them in churches sometimes just to control them. That should be a good picture. So here you have another serpent. Again on Leominster. I just happened to have a better camera with me at the time that I was in Leominster. I could take some of these pictures. It's not quite focused as well as it should be. I'm struggling with that. There. Thank you.
When?
This is in Kilpeck. Near Hereford in England. This is a church in which has picked up some of the artistic things and the ideas of the Norsemen which involved this great threat of the nature and sort of, you know, you're all caught up and you're all tied up and you're in knots. And here you've got this serpent gobbling things up.
Represents stress.
It's tremendous stress. Lions going at it. I mean, this stuff is beautiful. I love it. But when I look at it and I see what people were seeing in the Middle Ages and what they were dealing with, this is a baptismal font in Eardisley. It is not one of those things that you call just sweet and lovely. They're in battle. Another one, I should have brought another one with a lovely lion on it. But so Gates. You just never got rid of those Greek ideas. What are we looking at?
Centaur.
Mm-hmm. There's another one. Almost like a rocking house, but not this one. This has got to be my guest. Can you see it? What are they doing? A mama centaur.
Breastfeeding.
Breastfeeding another centaur.
Cool.
Isn't that cool? Iffley, Oxfordshire. I mean, you can. I'll tell you, seeing those old Romanesque churches is really a ball. I just love it. And I could play around all day with it. But just wanted to show you a few things. And this is, again, such a combination of the Greek, of the ideas that demonic was in distorted figures, and an incomprehensibility of what's out there. And when they drew maps, they drew maps including people that they imagined. People who had such a big foot that they could put it over their head as sunshade, or pig-nosed people, or something like that. A whole variety, strange, because they didn't know what was beyond in the unknown world. And devils, just everywhere. This is the fallen angel in there. Of course, St. Peter's, this is the 12th century, so St. Peter's got his keys. He's already there, dictating this to this fallen angel. And Judas, you know, obviously Jude, the devils not only saw to it that Judas got hung, but also tempted him into doing it. And so a lot of the devils are always there leading people into temptation. They believe that very seriously.
This is the tympanum and conch.
Have any of you been there?
Yeah, that's heaven and hell.
Yeah, heaven and hell. Conch is such a beautiful place. I want you to notice these little guys, because I'm going to show you this picture of these little, one of those little guys afterwards. But I won't repeat it. Whoops. Here's Jesus in the center of this conch tympanum, and he's standing there. This is his right hand. And his right hand is pointing up to, and maybe Evelyn, you can help you. He's pointing up to all those people that are going up to?
Up to heaven.
Up to heaven, okay?
Yeah.
Where is this hand?
Down.
Whoops. And here, this is a slanderer. So what you have on conch, if we go back, you can see all of this is becomes hell, and a whole description of different things that could happen to you. See this guy's mouth open, and people are, a lot of times the devils, they show the devils as eating people and then defecating them, and it happens over and over again. Isn't that fun? Wouldn't you love to join them? this is a slanderer, and I'm not sure what he's being fed, but he's being fed something that he doesn't like, I'll assure you, and that fire is a little hot there underneath. This is someone who is very greedy for gold, and they're melting gold and forcing him to drink it, melted gold. And there are so many more. I just didn't want to take a lot of time. But those little figures on the outside, you are constantly being watched. And they're so tiny, you don't even notice. And they're recording. They're taking note of what you are doing. And there is no way out. Augustine had said, ontological guilt, you cannot avoid the fact that your mother, that you were born into sin. There was no way out of this. And though you may want to get to heaven, but most people didn't have a lot of chance. So you look for ways out. This is also in Conch. This is Saint Foy or Saint Faith. This is a relic of a little girl of a martyr from the 3rd century. That would be the 200s. Supposedly there's an ankle bone in here. This is a statue that's about this big. This is no teeny thing. All gold, jewels. I tried to take a picture of it this year and all I get is a reflection, you know, because it's encased in glass. But they used to carry this relic around, there were candles in here. They used to carry this relic around through the village, through the valley, in order to, whenever there was a plague, when there was a famine, when there was a drought, and hoping that by carrying this figure around, that this relic would have power to change things. Now we're talking about not asking God for help. We're saying people were expecting that these saints, these martyrs, and there were a lot of martyrs in the early, those martyrs in the early church were very important people. So they save their bones and they are encased in a lot of different ways, and I'll show you some of those. They believed that they had been so good that they were able to intervene for them with God. This is a rational way of thinking about it, but in actuality, you know what people believed? They believed that this relic could actually make the difference on its own. You know they did. You know, you don't go through the whole rational thinking of it. Yeah. Saint Foy is so good. Saint Foy is up in heaven, and Saint Foy will talk to God for us. Sure. They're not that, you know. It's direct. I want email. I don't want to wait for the post office to get there. Saint Foy was actually stolen from Angers, A-N-G-E-R-S in France. Conch is also in France. The story goes that the people in Conch wanted to have a good relic. If you're going to have people come to your place and make your place rich, which is what was happening, because people would go on pilgrimages to these places in order, and we've got to talk about on that, we'll be talking about that on Saturday, more about pilgrimages. They wanted a good relic, one that people was known to have miracles, guaranteed to have miracles. So they wanted to go to some relic that had miracles. So they went to Angers, which had this relic of Saint Foy, and they sent one monk there. And he stayed there for 10 years, being a really good boy, until he could be in charge of this relic. And then he ran with it fast to Conch. Now, how could this happen? How could this relic that has powers to change the climate, to make people well, accept such a thing? The whole idea, they said, was that if the saint allowed his relic or her relic to be moved, it was okay. If he didn't, it couldn't happen. So therefore, we have the relic from St. Nicholas moved from Turkey into Bahrain in Italy, and it's all okay because the saint approved it. And here's a picture of Gregory the First, who actually is saying, you know, if we're going to have a church that actually develops, we have to have miracles. And so he approves of miracles, he encourages miracles, and you could not have a valid relic. You could not have anybody identified as a saint until there were miracles that were proven. And you could have a lot of devious, questionable miracles, things that we would not accept actually as miracles these days. One of the things that happened in about 723 is one of the councils said that if you're going to build a church, you must have a relic. And if you don't have a relic yet, you must get one. Mm-hmm. And I betcha in the Catholic churches now, if you go to any Catholic church, you scratch under the surface and there's a relic, because that's the rule. This is the hand of St. John the Baptist.
Mm-hmm. Who? John the Baptist.
And this is the scalp of St. John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. Not only did he lose his head, but now it's in jewel. We went to Dubrovnik and hear all these people saying, what in the world is that? You can guess now, can't you? Mm-hmm. See? And by now they had lost the identification of what saint's arm or what saint's leg or bone this was. But what's this? You know. It's a cross. Right? Yeah. What cross? What's inside of there?
Jesus.
Yeah, what's inside of there?
Sliver of wood
of
the true cross.
Of the true cross. So the legend goes that Constantine's mother Helen had found the true cross, and they say that there are enough pieces of the true cross around here to hang an awful lot of people on it. But they would not let anybody touch any of these relics because there was a good chance that they would take some of it with them. Especially people would, at first when they got hold of the true cross, did they kiss the cross? And might have tricked some with them. Mm-hmm. So they quit that. And this is Charlemagne's, and with very likely a piece of the true cross inside of it. Whether it's the real one or not, he thought it was, and that he thought, therefore, it was efficacious. I showed you Saint Trophime before, where those lions were, the bottom of the feet of the saints. And these are some of the reliquaries that are in Saint Trophime in the church in Arles. Here's Saint Roche. See the bones? Now, you can go in some places and see whole bodies. But if they were very important people, then their bodies would be broken up and spread around in different places. Here's Saint Trophime. You can see there's not very much of Saint Trophime there, but still it's a huge reliquary. Here's a piece of the reliquary with of Saint Anthony, a piece of the foot of Saint Anthony.
His tongue in some ways too.
I'm not sure what's in this reliquary, but it's a German reliquary from Modena. Beautiful stuff. You know, look how much. You can see how valuable these relics are when you see what they have put them into. Here's Saint Michel, the church of whom? Saint Michael. And so people went to say the church of Saint Michel and said, well, where's the Michael? An angel. So they're looking for a relic of an angel.
Where is Saint Michel?
It's on the northern coast of France, just a little bit east of Brittany. This slide is out of order. Well, these are, you show, so one of my daughters, these are two others. This is in Reading. Reading in England, the monastery has been pretty much destroyed, but it was one of the richest, held probably more relics than any other place. Rich, tremendously rich with relics. And that was part of the reason it was destroyed, in order to get all those relics.
Who destroyed it? Henry?
Well, Henry VIII and others were very happy to steal those relics.
Okay.
You realize how late that is. See, that's the 16th century. Here's a Chartres, and you know the most famous relic probably from Chartres is the Veil of the Virgin. Supposedly the reason why the church was built, because the veil was saved during the fire in 1091. And in Saint-Chapelle, this marvelous church in France was built by Louis the Ninth, in order to house the Crown of Thorns, which he paid multitudes of money for. And here's Charot in France. We came to this town. This is the Tower of Charlemagne. So if you've seen something of Charlemagne, you may recognize the similarity. Supposedly here, they had a relic, and this is pretty much destroyed now, the relic of, listen to me, the foreskin of Jesus.
Oh, my God.
The what? The foreskin of Jesus.
Oh, okay.
Huh.
Now, are you hearing how credible the people are? How credible these relics are? I mean, they had a tremendous amount of faith. And to some extent, their faith carried them over, and miracles did happen. Simply because they thought it would. And that happens to a lot of people in terms of healing and so forth. But the biggest, the only real relic that they had of Jesus, this is a picture of Saint Denis, was this, the bread, the mystery, the Holy Eucharist. And so really had nothing, no relic actually of Jesus except supposedly this foreskin, but they had the bread. And the bread became a mystery in itself. And they talk, there are stories about Jews stealing the bread and breaking it and it bleeding all over the place. Somebody saying, this isn't real, I'm puncturing it and it bleeds. People that want to take it home in order to feed their cabbages, and they stick it in their mouth and don't swallow it, and then it gets so big they can't get out the door. These are all stories that go on. This is the bread. And the people were not getting the cup. The bread became such an important thing. They said it didn't need to have the bread because within the body you had the blood as well, so you didn't need the cup. You had such tremendous, everything was there. And there are multitudinous stories about how people tried to use the bread and then used it, and then strange things happened. And similar things, I have to watch myself, because I can go on. I really want to go all the way to purgatory. Mary becomes a really very important person. Mary has a cult already in the 300s in the Eastern Orthodox Church. She is labeled Theotokos, the bearer of God, or the mother of God, in 431 in Ephesus, and that stays very strongly in the Eastern Church, and it doesn't get translated into the Western Church until quite a bit later. It really comes into the Western Church in the 1200s. That doesn't mean she wasn't there, but and she is already included in some of the liturgy and some festivals for her, but there is not this tremendous quality of her miracles. And if you have the story of, remember the story of Faust?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where someone sort of dedicates themselves to the devil, and then comes back and says, well, I'm sorry. Well, this is the kind of thing that Mary is always known for. Her miracles are sort of really strange. And remember, she's supposedly the intercessor. But, again, you have this conception of Mary really having the power in itself. And she is the one who says, they say, Jesus can't deny her anything because he loved his mother. Therefore, if you pray to Mary, you will get what you want, no matter what. And so you could be the worst guy as long as you've been praying to Mary. They talk about the nun who had a baby but had been praying to Mary, and she's pregnant, and comes back afterwards. She leaves the nunnery and comes back a year later after the baby's been born, and they are not surprised to see her. And they said, well, they realized, she realizes that all the time she was gone, Mary had taken her place for all that time, and they never missed that she was gone, even though she had this baby out of wedlock. The Black Virgin was very important. I want to spend a whole time just dealing with Mary. This is was a Black Virgin at Saint-Tournus in France, but has been painted now, so it's no longer a Black Virgin. But the Black Virgin was a very earth mother, a real fertility goddess in many ways. And the way she is standing here is much like Isis in the old Egyptian image of an Egyptian god. And I want to give you a chance to ask some questions. I don't want to just do everything. Because I can go on to purgatory, because purgatory is definitely a part of this. Anybody have any questions? I want to flip a light on.
He says keep going, just go ahead.
Keep on going.
Oh, there are more slides?
Yeah, there are more slides. But it's just, we have 5 minutes to go, and I want to give you a chance to respond to me. One of the things that Paul was saying today was when we were talking about the blind men, they said to the parents, who sinned? The blind man, who sinned that this man should have been born blind? Well, Jesus discounts that. That nobody sinned. But the medieval period definitely believed that anything that happened negatively came as a result of what you did wrong. So whether, even though in the Christian gospel it's not there, but the belief is nevertheless, that you were going to get it, and your life was in the balance. And if you realize this, I've actually got this sliding backwards. This guy's got his thumb down, so that you don't have a chance really when you really look at it. You don't have a chance. Ontological guilt, the sexuality of your parents, everything is against you. So the only way you can get out of it is to do what the church can do. You can only get out of it if you go along with the church. The church is the only way out. And the church tells everybody that very definitely. And so if you're excommunicated, if your king is excommunicated and you cannot have baptism, you are stuck. This is Dante writes the Divine Comedy in 1305. When Dante writes the Divine Comedy, it is a political satire. He puts all the people that he doesn't like in hell or in purgatory or someplace like that. But the structure that he creates the structure that he writes about is not something that he's created. The beliefs are something that are there. And I think it's very interesting to see which are the most important sins. Which sins get you the worst place? Cassius and Judas are down in the very pit of hell, for instance. But one of the things that the Catholic Church was teaching, and this comes from something in Maccabees, for if he were not expecting the fallen to rise again, it would have been useless and foolish to pray for them in death. Thus he made atonement for the dead that they might be freed from their sin. This is one of the basis for purgatory. So one of the things that happens in the church and it's developing during the years is that the church develops the idea that there is still hope for you even if you have not perfected your life in this life, that you may have a chance to work out your sins in purgatory. Now the Islam was having this same idea that you could be in sort of a place where you would be burnished, have all of your sins burned out of you so that you could actually face the light of Allah. So which came first, the chicken or the egg, whether the Christian idea of purgatory came first and they picked it up, of course Maccabees is Jewish. It's hard to say, but there are hints of it in the New Testament. Nothing that really says you can have a purgatory. But people are saying, well, what happens? You know, maybe there's a little bit of hope, huh? Maybe there's a little bit of hope. So what happens, the rule becomes in the church, if you have sinned, quote, no sin, if you have sinned, you have sinned something that way that you can really identify to the priest. You go to the priest and say, I've sinned, I'm contrite, please forgive me. The priest forgives them. But you still gotta clean up your act. You still have to compensate for the things that you have done wrong. So there are a whole variety of ways that you may compensate for that. One, if you don't have them all cleaned up, but you've been a pretty good boy or girl, you might end up going to purgatory. Now, one thing about purgatory is that there was hope. In hell, there was no hope. But in purgatory, you're dealing with, these people are carrying stones on them because, I can't remember what their sin was. It's in one of the lower levels of purgatory. But they're doing it happily because they know they're going to be saved. So if you go to purgatory, you have a chance that you might still be saved. These people are groveling because of their sins. They're groveling in the dirt. This is Dante and Virgil. Virgil is in limbo because he has not known Jesus. He can never even get to purgatory. He has to stay in the top level of hell because he has not been baptized. But Dante gives him it. He gets a chance to a purgatory. He can't get into paradise. And here these people are fornicators and they are being burned, chastised here. And in this picture, Cellinius, and I think that's his name, and Virgil and Dante are, in order to get to the forest, even to the garden, they must go through a bit of purgatory also. The idea of purgatory is very important in the terms of why people went on pilgrimages, why people went on crusades, why people did a lot of things that they did in order to receive penance, in order to receive some period of time lessened in purgatory. Now, I'm not going to talk anymore unless you've got a question. Would you turn on the light? How would you like to be a pastor at that time? Could you convince him?
I don't know.
We're past our time, so don't feel like you have to stick around and talk. But if you want to ask few questions I haven't given you a chance for. Don't hesitate.
We're through with the session.
That's another world, huh? Mm-hmm. You know, the crazy thing is it hasn't stopped. A lot of people are still believing that. A lot of people are running still to visions of the Virgin, or looking for something special.
First of all, she's going to say, has it changed much? Some of it hasn't.
No, some of it hasn't. We're still wondering.
Other superstitions in sermons. I'm retired now, so I go to churches.
And you hear superstition in churches? Is that what you're in sermons?
In sermon.
Like what?
Oh, I was walking down a path in the woods, and I didn't see that there was a bear in front of me, and here a stick jumped up and warned me or something. That I shouldn't walk down there, and that was Jesus taking
that
care
was,
of me.
Yeah.
And the people in the pews, I mean, particularly the people who've been in touch with the charismatic movement, their whole life is miracles. Mm-hmm. Everything's miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't conceive of being religious without miracles.
Yeah, I'm not going to deny miracles. I'm not going to deny miracles. Partly because if I denied miracles, then I would be blind. Because I don't know how God is acting in the world. See, in the Middle Ages, they thought God especially early in the Middle Ages, before the 12th century, they were thinking God was really a bad God. God was an angry God. God was out to get them. In the 12th century, they're beginning to see a different concept, and this is one of the things that, you know, if you have time to stick around, I can show you in art and actually show you some of the things and the reasons why that happened. But before that, gee, God, the Christian God was not fun.
He certainly wasn't in the Old Testament either.
Yeah, but he was a real protector God at the same time. I mean, you have both God, you know. He's a good guy, too. It's hard to understand. Hard to understand sometimes. And then notice I'm saying him now in the Old Testament, because this is the way people were seeing God, pretty much. And this is also Latin, where God was definitely male. I think that's one reason why the 12th century, why Mary became so important. They were looking for a feminine aspect, a soft aspect, somebody that could alleviate this pressure of this really, really mean God.
I think that's true, because see, the Greeks and Romans, they had the women gods. They had as many women as men. And maybe when they tried to switch over, they had to have a substitute woman god. And thought, well, Mary will help that, particularly with women. Because if women had to think that all God was male and was not good,
we're always looking for a soft touch there. You know, in the Eastern Church, one of the things that we have is you see the Holy Spirit there is Hagia Sophia. And what gender is that?
Mm-hmm.
Feminine. See, in the Latin Church, it's Spiritus Sanctus, which is male. So you have a much more male presence, much more greater male presentation in the Western than in the Eastern Church. And Mary is very strong in the Eastern Church. Anyway.
Wow.
By the way, there's going to be a film tomorrow evening on The Sorceress, which involves some of this stuff and some other things too, which can be, it's not a great film, but it's got some great ideas in it. And then I'll be talking on pilgrimages on Saturday afternoon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have a session tomorrow during the day?
Nope.
Do what?
Nope.